It may be a goofy day, particularly when I still have Monday, October 24th listed in the slides, even though today is clearly Wednesday, October 26th. This is not Groundhog Day. I did change the birthdays, so it is Hillary Rodham Clinton's birthday, so happy birthday to one of our two presidential candidates that we will select in under 2 weeks. Seth MacFarlane, who is very, very well known for Family Guy and for being a fabulous improvisational actor. Pat Sajak, if you want to pick a letter or turn a number, then you talk to Vanna with Pat. Carrie Elwes, for those of you that are Princess Bride fans, like I am. And Keith Urban, for those of you that are Nicole Kidman's husband fans, like I am. So today is National Pumpkin Day, less than a week to Halloween, and it is also Intersex Awareness Day, so hug your favorite intersex friend, whoever that may be, even though you may not know they're like that. So, but be aware. So I have all the exams to return, and I'll go over some common misconceptions a bit in class today. I won't go over too many of the details because Anna's sitting right there over at the table, and she's going to make up this exam right after the class, so I can't review all of the problems for you right now. But I am going to post solutions, and I will post grade distributions after I get that test through Anna after class today. Since there's one person still left to take the midterm, that also means that I won't send out that email with everybody with their grades today and their class rank until later on today, so I have all the data. But I'll get that out today, I promise. And that's really important because at least the final drop deadline is Tuesday, November 8th. Vote early, vote often, maybe drop physics or not, who knows. But at the very least, I need to give you that information well before the drop deadline so you can make informed decisions about what you're going to do. So Halloween is next Monday. I'll certainly bring candy. I should have brought some today. And as I mentioned on Monday, in 2 weeks, I'm out. So Balsha Terzic will be lecturing on Monday. And there will be just class notes posted on Wednesday, but no actual class session. I was going to ask, however, if we can, maybe if you can be here and have a review session for students who are interested in it that Wednesday. So I'll put that in the class syllabus. So that way, if there's any questions about how to work certain problems, we can work them through that Wednesday. Any questions so far? So far, you know, wherever we are. We started after that midterm, and now we're moving on really solidly into the second half of the semester. I went over a lot of material on Monday related to rotational kinematics and showing rotational coordinate systems, how those are just, you divide things by R and all of rotational kinematics. You just divide your old kinematics equations by R. So I've extended the slide set, but the slide set that I have reviews exactly all of that, right? We went through a review or a reminder about one-dimensional kinematics, about velocity, about position, about acceleration and constant acceleration, and our old friend, the movie equation from way back when, and then talked about how in rotational coordinate systems, at least, angle is the position coordinate rather than x, rather than position, and angle is a ratio of distance divided by the radius. The radius is in some, you know, what a physicist would call a length scale, right? You divide all dimensions by length, by the radius, and here you get angles as distance around the circle divided by the radius. And the natural the natural unit for that is radians in all of science and engineering. So live, learn, love, take your calculator and put it on radians, and then take that key off your calculator pad so you can't change it back to degrees. So radians is just everywhere. We talked a little bit about then taking that position coordinate, taking the time derivative, and that is an angular velocity, just like linear velocity. So just like angular position is theta, is equal to some distance, or theta, some distance is equal to theta times r. If you take a derivative of that, you get a linear velocity is related to angular velocity by multiplying by r, the same exact thing. And we played a little bit with an applet and did a few problems. And acceleration, tangential acceleration, is also related to angular acceleration via the same equation. So there's really a key. It's very easy to get these accelerations confused, and that's exactly why I included a picture in there to clarify them, right? If I've got something moving around in a circle, so I'll draw, you know, a little summary slide or something like that. This distance is s. This distance is r. If I move through a certain angle of theta, then I can relate those three things. S is equal to theta times r. And because s is a distance and r is a distance, you can clearly tell that here theta is dimensionless. And that really means that the units of radians, you don't need to cancel out with other radians, right? They don't get carried around all the time. A radian, an angle expressed in radians, really is fundamentally a ratio between two distances. So it's not a real unit in the sense that meters or seconds or some other units are that you have to carry around with you all the time. It's very easy to get confused and have radians kind of appear and disappear in a problem, but that's fundamentally because radians are not a real unit. So now if I take a derivative with respect to time, how are these things changing? Well, the derivative of a position with respect to time is velocity. The radius isn't changing if I'm going around the circle of constant radius. So instead I have d theta dt, which is this omega, right? And this is angular velocity. And then if I take another derivative with respect to time, I get acceleration. And now this is acceleration going around the circle. That little notation here means tangential acceleration. Is equal to some alpha, which is angular acceleration. Times r again. Everything is kind of scales by R's, R, R, R. Feels like talk like a pirate day. This comment about tangential acceleration is different than centripetal acceleration. By now, you know that equation is v squared over r. And, well, v is just omega r, so I could also make this omega squared over r. So what's really happening in this world is that as I spin something up, there's a tangential acceleration. There's a coordinate system here, which is tangent to the circle, going around the circle. There is also an acceleration that points towards the center of the circle, that keeps you going in the circle, keeps you going rotationally around a circle of constant radius, that centripetal acceleration. And you can see that this coordinate system, that coordinate system is 90 degrees. It's like a real coordinate system that rotates around with the particle. But those two are just like x and y accelerations. Those two are now kind of radial and tangential accelerations, but they're still 90 degrees apart. And so the total acceleration vector here, those are two components of a total acceleration that the object is experiencing. And so I might ask, or you might see in homework, something is going around the circle and a torque, a turning force is being applied to make it go faster or slower around that circle. And so now you need to calculate the centripetal acceleration component and the tangential acceleration component, a sub t, and work through the math to add those together to figure out which direction the total acceleration is pointing. This is very common in, you know, the classic example of this is, again, the race car driver going around the curve, right? Where he's hitting the gas as he's going around the curve on a banked, you know, on a banked curve even. Okay, he's hitting the gas, so he's going faster around the curve, but he's also got to turn into the curve to stay on the curve. So his acceleration is not just forward, his acceleration is in a bit. And there's some angle that you can only calculate if you know both of those components. You notice that you don't have to worry about the velocity this way. If you're going around the curve of constant radius, your radial velocity is never changing, the radial component of your velocity. You're going around the curve. If you were moving in or out, you wouldn't be on a curve of constant radius. So the velocity, the radial velocity doesn't change. This is purely what you might think of as the tangential component of the velocity. And this thing down here, this centripetal acceleration, is related to the tangential component of the velocity squared over r, and that omega squared over r is clearly not right, right? This thing, that should be an omega squared times r, right? Take this v sub t, plug it in there, I get omega squared r squared, cancel out the r, I get omega squared times r. If you express this in the angular terms, okay? So rotational kinematics here, as it relates to traditional linear kinematics, is now this funny coordinate system that's rotating around. This is a v sub t, like the tangential component of the velocity, right? The velocity is only tangential here. So vt is equal to the tangential velocity. And yes, this is a v sub t, just like this is a v sub t up here. Okay. And in fact, the radial component of velocity in problems like this, where the radius is constant, I'm not moving in or out, is zero, right? There is this idea of this coordinate system existing, right? This coordinate system, this is tangential, and this is radial. This is like, you know, x and y, right? It's just another orthogonal 90 degree apart coordinate system. those of you that end up doing somewhat harder courses in mechanics and rotational things like this, you'll find out, and we don't cover that in this course, but you find it out soon enough, that in a world like this, where this coordinate system itself is now changing, we always had done problems before where we just draw the coordinate system, and the coordinate system stays fixed. As the object moves, these coordinates stay fixed. But now here in rotational motion, the coordinate system itself, radial and tangential, is changing as you go around the circle. And that actually introduces other effects. If you've ever heard of something like the Coriolis force, the reason why hurricanes exist, okay, it's because the Earth is rotating, and as the Earth rotates, the coordinate system of the storm on the side of the Earth is moving along, and some things are moving around in smaller radii at different latitudes than others. And there's a shear, there's a force that's produced that actually makes the hurricane spin. The same thing, it's a coordinate system that's changing as you follow a particle through the system. And that changing coordinate system, whenever I do something like take a time derivative, here I assume the radius was constant, so I just took a time derivative of the position coordinate. In a very general sense, if I take a time derivative of this, I gotta take a time derivative of the position times the radius, and I gotta take the position times the time derivative of the radius, and add them together, and things get a lot more complicated. We don't have to worry about that in this course. For circular motion, you're assuming the radius is constant. Mechanical engineers, most of the time you're dealing with a system which is a gear where the radius doesn't change, or a rope wrapped around a spindle or something like that. The radius is generally constant, and all of this stuff applies. Okay? So this is board one, and that's kind of a summary of the connections and the coordinate system, which is a bit deep. It's neat, but it's different. It illuminates the differences from what you've seen with traditional linear motion before. And this is, from the text, a little illumination of that picture with the angular velocity going around the circle. And then, just like I drew, that combination of tangential and radial accelerations adding up to a net acceleration. We had talked through an example, and I worked through it on a board about how when you're biking you get leverage because you're turning a crank with a larger gear, which connects then to a smaller gear in the back connected to your wheel. So for every turn of your big wheel here, you're going to turn the back wheel, you know, maybe a couple of times, right? The circumferences are definitely different. So if I turn that front wheel and the chain doesn't slip once, the back wheel has got to go through a couple of revolutions to have the same distance of chain traversed. And you can, using these equations, calculate out some ratios that also connect not just the radii to the distances, but the radii to the angular velocities and the angular accelerations. If I'm changing the speed at which I pump, I'm going to have to change the speed of how my rear tire turns a lot more. And the same goes with the accelerations. This particular technique, by the way, where you take two different equations and you have two different situations, like omega 1 and R1, and omega 2 and R2, and they're both equal to the same thing, so you get ratios. Lots of stuff cancels out. Very useful trick. You'll see it again and again and again through your education, probably. So there was a nice little summary that I had put in the slides from the old textbook that I talked from that has the connection between linear quantities, linear position, linear velocity, and angular quantities. Angular, angular position, which is just angle, angular acceleration, and then all of the equations, if I just took any of our old standard kinematic equations and divide them by r on both sides, or in the last case by r squared, I can put one of those r's under the a and get an alpha, and one of those r's under the positions and get thetas. Same equations, they just have funny symbols. And then we work through some example problems in class, right down to a turntable turning. This is problem 9.13 from the book. And a counterweight elevator moving around. And there it was very, very straightforward because it's just converting linear distance to raise the elevator into angular distance of this disk turning. So essentially all of this problem is taking these numbers and dividing by r and converting linear velocity to angular velocity, or linear acceleration to angular acceleration, or linear distance to angular distance. All three of these are just divide by r and you're done. Now, the one other thing that I started to go through at the end of class last time, and we're going to start with it this time again, is the more complicated part of rotational motion. And it'll lead us into gyroscopes and gyroscopes. And true three-dimensional aspects of rotational motion are why it's at this part of the semester. I mean, normally I would take this stuff and I would put it all with regular kinematics, because this is kinematics. And it should have been with the first part of the semester when we did kinematics in a linear sense. And I can just say, hey, you do the same exact thing, just divide by r everywhere, and it's angular kinematics, and you're done. And everybody kind of gets a happy feeling in their tummy because they kind of get double duty. They learn two things for the price of one. You learn one little trick, divide by r, and all of a sudden all your linear and angular kinematics is just all one thing, kinematics. But the slightly more complicated thing about this is signs. And I have something on the next slide, but I'll point it out on this board as well. Okay. And that is, if I want to really treat these things properly with respect to signs, how do I tell if this distance, you know, going around that way is positive or that way is positive? And that looks like an X. There you go, positive. Right? Is going around this way positive or that way positive? And just like in kinematics, where you have to treat all of your signs consistently, and Newton, where you have to treat all of your signs consistently, or else you're going to get it wrong. Rotational motion, you have to treat all your signs consistently. But now it's much more difficult because this thing is, you know, this is moving that way down here, but it's moving that way up there. And they're both the same rotation, but in this coordinate system, that's positive and that's negative. So I can't use this coordinate system anymore. I can't just draw one direction and say that direction is positive in a traditional XY sense. What I have to do is I have to be able to look at the rotation and use a direction, define an axis somewhere that's positive and negative for one turn like this being positive and one turn like that for being negative. I could draw something like this. I could say counterclockwise is positive and clockwise is negative, or vice versa. But the real way you do it is you say, I live in a lovely three-dimensional world. All of this stuff has been drawn on a two-dimensional surface. I've got a free axis. I've got a free direction that I can use and draw a direction that says, okay, something pointing in this direction is positive and this direction is negative. That's perpendicular to the rotation motion. And this goes right back to the right hand rule, where if you curl your hand in the positive direction around a rotation, your thumb will point in the positive direction. So let's say that that direction is positive. If that direction is positive, something that's pointing up here is really the positive direction. And anything that I'm talking about that is an angle, a positive angle, going from here to here, well, if I go from there to there, I curl my fingers in that direction, and that positive angle, in a vector sense, really points up. And the negative angle would really point down in a vector sense. And positive angular velocity, same thing, and positive acceleration, the same thing. Okay? So, when I'm talking in terms of vectors for these things, the angle, the angular velocity and angular acceleration, positive as a vector term, points up. And if you're dealing with these things as vectors, those vectors are no longer in this plane. This is weird, right? And this is a little bit complicated now, because you'd think that, okay, I have acceleration defined as a vector related to alpha. Angular acceleration that I'm now defining as a vector as well. And they don't point in the same direction. Well, this R was a vector too. And in fact, if I have an angular acceleration there and a radius pointing out, the real true, right, if I've got the real vector definition of how this acceleration equation really works, is the tangential acceleration. I've got the tangential acceleration, I've got the angular acceleration pointed up, and I've got a radius pointed out there. The angular acceleration pointed up cross with that radius is equal to alpha. So this thing in a true vector term, vector sense, is the tangential acceleration is equal to the vector alpha crossed with the vector r. And I'll remind everybody what a cross product is in a second. This simple scalar thing works only if you're thinking in terms of simple scalars. But everything is a vector. Acceleration is a vector. It points somewhere. Radius is a vector. It points somewhere. A magnitude and a direction. Angular acceleration points somewhere. It's a magnitude and a direction. Clockwise or counterclockwise. So what is that cross product? Let's review that real quick again. I know a bunch of you have seen it. I know a bunch of you haven't. So this is the slide that I wrote last time when I started to talk about cross products in terms of torque, which is another cross product. But let's just talk in terms of two general vectors now. Two general vectors, A and B. I can draw them anywhere. If they're not on top of each other, they span a plane. They define a plane. So I can put them on a plane. There's some angle in between them. And now I want to define some way of multiplying those vectors that gets a vector. So a cross product fundamentally is a way of multiplying vectors to get a vector. To figure out the magnitude of it, you take the product of the two vectors and you take the sign, multiply that by the sign of the angle in between them. the direction of that product, the direction of this vector that's given by the cross product of these two vectors, is perpendicular to both of them, by definition, with that direction being defined by this right-hand rule. A cross B, it points up. B cross A, I take my fingers, point them in the direction of the first vector. If it's B cross A, I curl them in the direction of the second vector, A, and my thumb points in the direction of the cross product, which B cross A would point down. Ah, A cross B, B cross A, I just realized a little property of the cross product is that it's anti-commutative. Reversing the two vectors reverses the sign of the end thing, which is just fine. If I reverse this angle, if I take sine of 30 degrees or sine of minus 30 degrees, yep, the sign changes sign. So if I've got two vectors and they lay on top of each other, the cross product is zero. The sine of zero is zero, right? That angle in between them is 0 degrees. So a cross product is a way of taking two vectors, multiplying them together, and getting a vector. And it turns out that you need that to really, truly, properly treat rotational motion in all of its beautiful glory, because now you've got vectors going clockwise or counterclockwise, and you need to be correct about the signs. It all goes back to the signs. So far, so good. Okay? And trust me, you'll see cross products a lot more next semester in second, in 232, and you'll see them a lot more in Calc 3, where the curl is a derivative cross product kind of thing, which is all great fun. So as I was pointing out on this board, right, with rotational motion of the circle, all of those things, position, right, the theta going around the circle, really a vector that points up or down, perpendicular to the circle. Angle, really a vector pointing up or down. Right? Angular velocity, angular acceleration, the same thing. And it's all given by the right-hand rule. So we went through all of kinematics, linear kinematics, rotational kinematics. We worked through some examples there. That's fine. That was the first several weeks of the course combined into one, 45-minute discussion and a few example problems. But a lot of what we covered is Newton. A lot of what we covered, in fact, you might say the entire theme of first semester college-based physics is put you in a Newtonian frame of mind. Take Newton and stick Newton in your head and think of the world in terms of forces, accelerations relating to those forces, all of these things as vector quantities, so you need to practice all your vector math. And now what we do is we take those concepts, just like we had position and velocity and acceleration as angular concepts, there must be an angular analog to force, and that's torque. Everybody here is familiar kind of with the term gearheads a lot more than other people, because you reprogram torque curves into your engines, into your engine's computer to get the best acceleration off the line in your car or something like that. You're converting mechanical power into turning power of your wheels. Torque is a turning force, just like angle, just like acceleration, angular acceleration, just like angular velocity. It's all defined around the turning axis. So you've got to have a reference point, a reference axis that you're turning around. Take the door, right? You push on a door and the door rotates, you've got
except for y'all in the cheap seats over there. Hi. You're clearly rotating the door around its hinges, right? So you've got a reference axis through the hinges. If I take a meter stick and twirl it in my fingers like I'm tempted to do because I'm a fidgeter, right? I'm rotating it through the center, but I could also use it like a pendulum and swing it through one end. And boy, gosh, this thing is easier to turn like this through that axis than it is to turn like this through the axis that's way at one end of the thing. So, now I'm starting to get complicated because turning force to do something depends on where the axis is. Let's talk about the kinematics first. Let's talk about the variant, F equals ma, and how do I convert between a linear force of a push on a door to a turning force. And then we'll get into a little bit later what the analog is for mass as you're turning. Because all of those things have rotational variance, and they are all different, and frankly, all a little more complicated and just traditional linear stuff. So torque depends on your distance, right? If I take the door again, the reason why the door's handle is way over here is because it's got the most leverage, right? It's got the furthest distance you can get on the door from the turning axis. But if I were to put the, all my force right here, just do it close. Of course, it's much easier to push the door open than to turn the door if I've got a larger lever on, which every kind of, 5 or 6 or 7 year old knows. So torque, turning force, turning ability, must be related to radius, just like all of the other things, angular position, angular velocity, angular acceleration, they were all scaled with radius. So torque must be radius related to the force I apply. Just like all the other stuff. And just like all the other stuff, though, the radius is a vector. The force is a vector. I'm taking a radius and a force, and I'm multiplying them together, and I'm getting something that better have a sign. Am I pushing clockwise or am I pushing counterclockwise? So torque better be a vector. So I've got a radius, which is a vector. I've got a force, which is a vector. I've got a torque, which is a direction, has a direction and a magnitude. So it better be a vector too. Sure sounds like the cross product that I just taught you about. Already, so torque is radius crossed with force, okay? That is the definition of torque. And if you take the angle in between the applied force and the applied radius, you can calculate out exactly what the torque is, right? So it's fairly straightforward once you know what the definition is, and yes, I'd give it to you, right? Torque is radius cross force, okay? And you better be careful with this. Do not get this confused and say F cross R, right? Because we know from the property of the cross product that that would get the sign wrong. And we know that to calculate the magnitude of this thing, it's the magnitude of the radius, it's the magnitude of the force, and then it's the sine of the angle in between them. And that angle, you have to get that angle right. The sine of that sine, right? That angle goes from the radius to the force. It goes from the first thing to the second thing. So let's say, I've got something here, a radius, and I'm applying some force.
And those two things are 90 degrees apart. Okay. Is that plus 90 or minus 90? The sign is different. The sign of plus 90 is plus 1. The sign of minus 90 is minus 1. So you better draw the picture. I always like to draw the picture like this, head to tail. Or even, actually, it's best to do this. The radius is in that direction. The force is in that direction. This is plus 90 degrees. If this radius were over here, and the force were pulling down, I could redraw these things like this. The force is pointing down. The radius points that way. All that matters with these pictures is direction and putting base to base. It does not mean that the force is really being applied at the center of that radius. This is just a mechanism to get the angle right. And here, that angle is minus 90 degrees. Okay? So these are only pictures to get the sine of the angle right. And then after that, you just multiply out. It's just, physics is done. It's all math. Radius is 1 meter. Force is 5 newtons. So that's, 5 newton meters times the sine of whatever angle it is. And it's plus or minus, depending on which one of these pictures you're talking about. And that's nice and happy because, that direction is positive and that direction is negative. And I get a positive number here, since that's plus 90. I get a minus 90 number here because that's minus 90. All the complication is in getting the actual sine of the angle right, going from the first thing to the second thing in a cross product. Okay? And generally, if you're looking at a problem like this, don't try and shortcut it. If you're impatient about it at this stage of the game, put the two vectors base to base and draw the angle. There is no shame in it. You will always get the answer right. If I look at this just naively, that kind of feels like positive 90. Not really. It's really negative 90. You could also think of this as being positive 270. I have to go from the radius all the way around to the force. But generally, putting vectors base to base, in my experience, is a no-fail way to always get the sine of this angle correct. And then remember, the angle goes from the first thing to the second thing. That's the hard part about torque. Okay? So if I've got let's say I've got this door, right? And I've got the door. And that door has a certain distance or a radius r. Now I can also look at different forces, applied to that door and figure out what the torques are. And clearly the torque is going to be maximum when this for the same radius and the same force, the torque is going to be maximum when this thing is 90 degrees. That's why you take something and you push, straight against it. Use all your force. Some of your force otherwise would get translated into radial force, pushing the thing into the hinges or pulling the thing off the hinges, which doesn't help you turn. Might help damage the door, but it doesn't help you turn. That's everything there is associated with this torque. Okay? In this case, so now I'll ask you, What is the direction of the torque in each of these cases? Where does the torque point in this case? Does it point anywhere on the board? Does it point out of the board or into the board? Okay, right-hand rule, R cross F, the torque points out of the board. The usual way that physicists draw that is a circle with a dot. A circle with a dot means out of the board, or out of the picture. Because it's like you're looking at an arrowhead, and the point of the arrow is pointing at you. Here, R cross F, it points down into the board, and the usual way we draw that is we draw an X, like you're seeing the feathers of the arrow, the butt end of the arrow, as you're looking at it. So X is into the picture of the board. So the torque direction here is pointing out of the board, and the torque direction here is pointing into the board. That's why their signs are different. Okay, and I went through some of that, last time, but I went through it a lot more detail this time. So, think about that question. Whoops. Don't think about that question yet. Think about that question. Right? Same force, three different directions. I'm grabbing a wrench and I'm pulling on it. So which force produces the maximum torque and which force produces the minimum torque? Right, you grab 90 degrees. Certainly this force, you can trust your gut. You grab on this thing and you pull perpendicular to the radius to produce a maximum torque. So a maximum torque is up here. You're going to turn that wrench if you really yank on it like that. Unless that nut is frozen, of course. The last picture, on the other hand, you're acting completely radially. You've got no tangential force at all. So you've got no force perpendicular to the radius. The angle between the force and the radius is zero. Torque equals R cross F, RF sine theta. Theta is equal to zero, I guess, just like the normal force and the work in all of those homework problems and some of the exam problems, where the work was equal to zero. Here again, you've got the perpendicular things giving you, the parallel things giving you no torque. So you don't turn it all here in the last item, item C. You produce the maximum torque, of course, 90 degrees. And here is somewhere in the middle. You've got both a force radially and a force tangentially. It's like a true 2D mechanics problem where you've got both radial and tangential forces. So that's the force analog. Okay, F equals MA. I figured out forces. I figured out acceleration, right? Acceleration is a vector. An angular acceleration is a vector produced by R cross A, just like torque is R cross F. It's like you're taking all of Newton's law, F equals MA, and you're taking R cross everything. So you think maybe the mass just stays the same. But as I just showed you with the meter stick, turning the meter stick through different positions and different radii is easier to do and harder to do in other places. It's always easiest to turn something if I grab it through its center of mass and keep as much mass as I can as close to the place where I'm trying to turn it as I can. So what's the appropriate analog for Newton's law? The appropriate analog for Newton's law is, in fact, torque equals I alpha. F equals ma in rotational terms. And I, now thank God, we don't have to multiply scalars or anything like that. It's just as easy to turn this thing this way around this point, right, as it is to turn it this way around this point. A moment of inertia is something that is already includes kind of all the vector calculations about how hard something is to turn. But thank heavens, a moment of inertia is a scalar thing. So the torque is in the same direction as the angular acceleration in a vector sense. When I turn something, I'm turning it positive or negative, and that should be consistent with the direction of the alpha, the acceleration, in a positive or negative sense. So great. Thank heavens, let's, you know, at least give us one equation without a friggin' cross product in it. But now we have to figure out what this I is, because it ain't mass. And as a matter of fact, I can immediately tell it's not mass. Now, Todd, can I tell it's not mass? Okay. Well, we have Newton. Okay, so this is rotational Newton now. Rotational Newton is torque is equal to I alpha. Okay. Now remember, or, you know, let's keep the vectors out of it for a second. Now remember, torque here was equal to, what was it? It was equal to R F times the sine of theta. Right, and alpha was equal to what? Right, it was alpha is equal to A over R. So torque as units of a force times a distance. Right. Gosh, torque kind of looks like work. Has the same units, newton meters or joules. Everybody expresses torque in terms of newton meters. Nobody expresses torque in terms of joules. But it's the same unit. The alpha units? Okay. Well, alpha is now acceleration over distance, which means it's like something inverse second squared. To make these units work in this equation, this works if and only if the units of I are what? Well, I've got to have, so a newton meter, a newton is a mass times acceleration, right? So newton is equal to a kilogram times meters divided by second squared. Mass is in kilograms, acceleration is in meters per second squared. So that means a torque as units of this thing times meters, kilograms times meters squared per second squared. This alpha, I said, has units of inverse second squared. So for torque to be equal to something times alpha, that something is going to have units of kilograms times meters squared. That I is not just a mass. It's got lengths in it again. gosh, okay, that kilogram looks like a mass. And that meter squared, the only distance I've got to work with on anything is radius stuff. So when we actually try and figure out what it means to have this moment of inertia, we're going to have to take masses and multiply them by r squareds to get everything right. Okay. I think I have the same argument in the next slide of the slide deck, where I substitute in everything and work through the various units. And torque equals I alpha. Looks like F equals ma if and only if the torque looks like, or the moment of inertia looks like something like mass times radius squared. Now, if I've got a point mass that I'm trying to move around through a radius, that's all there is to it. So let's say I'm trying to take some, you know, a mobile, right, that's hanging from a ceiling, and I'm trying to push it around. Well, the mobile, I can pretty much just treat as very light rods hanging from a central axis and big masses on the end that are all balanced. So to push that thing around, that moment of inertia is that mass times its distance from the axis squared. Mass times radius squared of a single point mass. I got two of them, well, they add up. It's just as hard to move. Just like I can add two masses, I can add two things like this. But they might have different radii, right? The mobile might be balanced so that there's a bigger mass shorter and a smaller mass further out. So when I add them all together, I really need to add their individual masses and individual radii squared to get that total moment of inertia. If I can add two things together, I can add three things together, I can add four things together, I can add an infinite number of things together, and I can end up getting an integral. And in fact, that's exactly what you get, is you take, for any solid thing, you take all the different pieces of its mass and you add them together and weight them by their radius squared. And you integrate the radius squared over the entire distribution of the mass for a continuous piece of mass. And you'll be given tables. I'll show you some examples of simple things that you can use to calculate this type of stuff. But it's actually, believe it or not, in the very old days, when people didn't know how to calculate particular integrals, what you could do is you could construct a mass that has a funny shape, and you say, how do I do the integral of this function? What I can do is I can build a mass that looks like that function and measure how hard it is to rotate and figure out this moment of inertia, and then I know the integral of that function. I can experimentally kind of integrate a function by building something weird and rotating it, which is pretty cool. But that's, this is another reason why this is at this point in the semester, is that moments of inertia, it's really hard to do interesting things with torque and rotating objects and stuff like that without actually doing the integral of a moment of inertia. Because there are only so many problems where, oh, a mobile is hanging on the ceiling, and this is radius 3 centimeters, and that's radius 7 centimeters, and there are two-point masses sitting around. That's for 1/12. You guys are engineers. You deal with disks. You deal with solid, extensible objects. You're going to have to deal with how does that cylinder, how does that disk, how does that sphere rotate as I change it and move it around in space. because physical things like that have real physical extensions. And yes, it means you do the integral. That being said, here's a table. Okay? And that being said, if you are ambitious, this is basically Calc 2, applied Calc 2, or even a little bit of Calc 3 in the case of the three-dimensional objects, but all of these can be treated as two-dimensional objects, right? If I take this rod and I spin it around the center, you'll notice that everything here has the total mass of the object times some length of the object as part of its moment of inertia, right? This rod spinning around the center is 1/12 mL squared. The length of the rod times the mass, you know, squared times the mass, times 1/12. Turns out if I do that integral of this thing, I get there. Yes, it's harder to spin it around the end. If I take it and spin it around the end, what I'm doing is I'm here. If I spin it around the center, I only go out, I only have to do my integral from a radius of minus L over 2 to plus L over 2. And a bunch of my mass is as close as, you know, kind of as close as is possible to the turning axis. But if I go here and turn it around the end, oh, now I have to go from a radius of 0 all the way out to L. And there's a lot more mass at a lot larger radius. And that integral becomes bigger. How much bigger? Well, it goes from 1/12 to 1/3. And that is not obvious. Right? If you were just to try and calculate it out without calculus, good luck. I'm not sure you're going to get a ratio of, you know, 1/3 to 1/12, figuring that out. Just thinking of this in terms of the mobile with point mass here and point mass there. You got to do the calculus. There's a sphere, there's a ring there. So a ring spinning around the center. Let's say I take a washer and I roll a washer down an inclined plane. That looks just like that ring spinning around its center. I take my marbles and I flick my marbles across the table. It's just like a sphere spinning around the center. Or you could kind of try and look at it as the sphere spinning around the point where it contacts the table, too. We'll get to that in a second. But these are simple examples of moment of inertia. And they all have... If you ever don't know a moment of inertia, just write down constant times mass times whatever length is associated with the object squared. And at least you're dimensionally in the right ballpark. It may be 1/12 or 1/3 or 1/2 or 2/5 or whatever. But the dimensions of moment of inertia, mass times length squared. Okay? So now that I got that, right, the larger the moment of inertia, it's like the larger the mass. The harder it is to accelerate for a given torque. The harder it is to spin up. So if I've got a solid ball, and this is a classic example, I mean, maybe we can even get the equipment to do it next time in class and show it, or I'll assign it as a homework problem, because I'm sure it's in the homeworks video somewhere. I have a plane, and I take a solid ball and a hollow ball with the same mass, and I let them go, and I let them roll down the plane. So if I take those two and I roll them down the plane, if there's no friction at all, they're both the same mass, they're both the same object, they're both sliding down the same inclined plane, they both get to the bottom at the same time, because that is your linear kinematics, that's your linear Newton stuff, right? Same mass, same plane. If they're balls, though, and they're balls where there's enough friction that all they can do is turn, one of them is harder to spin around the center than the other. Which one, the solid ball or the hollow ball? For the same mass. Okay. Which one has more mass further away from the center? The hollow ball.
Okay? A hollow ball has all of its mass, the radius away from the center. The solid ball has a lot of mass kind of close to the center. That lot of mass kind of close to the center is easier to turn because it's not moving very far. If I had a sphere that was, you know, like styrofoam with a big BB in the middle or something like that, where almost all of its mass was exactly in the middle, it would be real easy to turn. There's hardly any mass at the edges to turn. So something like a hollow ball with all of its mass in the edges is hard to turn. That's a lot of mass out there at the radius. So that means it accelerates more slowly. It's got bigger mass, it's harder to rotate. So the hollow ball starts turning and going down the plane more slowly than the solid ball. And the solid ball will reach the bottom first, I think. Okay, if you really want to see me improvise, let's Google a video and see if we can find a video. Because that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it. I'm happy to be wrong, but that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it. Those things are all... I'm expecting to find one of my videos in here, actually. Let's look at a ring disk and a sphere, which is very, very similar. Okay. What? Yeah, right. It must be, right? Julian Sumner Milner, whoever that is. So this example is similar to the one I just talked about, except now that is like a billiard ball. That's a solid billiard ball, the red guy. The guy in the middle is a cylinder with all of its mass on the edge, a ring. Okay? And then the one on the very end there is like a cylinder with filled in, though, so it's a solid cylinder. So there's more mass in the middle. So our guess here, right, certainly all of this mass around the same axis here, all of the mass of the middle guy is furthest away from the center of rotation, from the axis of rotation, right? It's like the hollow ball that I was talking about. You've got a lot more mass around that ring, so that ring is going to lose the race, my argument is. Okay, it's sure losing that race because it takes the most time to spin up because it's got the most mass furthest away from the center of rotation. You can also see here that the ball and the cylinder that's filled both have about the same amount of mass near the axis of rotation. If you look down the axis of rotation, it's even a little bit hard to tell which is which. The cylinder has a little bit more mass further away from the center in the furthest and back ends than the sphere, which has those pieces carved out. So the sphere is winning a little bit, but we could actually go through all the math and calculate how much one of these wins over the others. But certainly, that seems consistent with the argument that the hollow ball will lose and the solid ball will win. Something with the smallest moment of inertia will get to the bottom first because it can spin up the fastest and most quickly. Okay, so far so good. Here's an example. Then we'll take a break, and we'll come back and do parallel axis theorem, which you guys get, but Wynn 12 doesn't, because it's calculus again. But this is an example of one of those calculations. It's
to get something from this table. I went through the calculus and calculated out what's the moment of inertia, what is this integral, integral of r squared dm, for a uniform rod spinning around its center like this meter stick. Hey, so you take small slices along the length of the rod. You're only integrating along one dimension since it's a one-dimensional object. How much mass does each little slice have? Well, it has that little slice over the entire length times the mass of the entire rod, right? If I take a slice that's half of the rod, it has half of the mass. If I take a slice that's a quarter of the rod, it is a quarter of the rod. The mass. So if I take a slice that's dr over L of the rod, it has dr over L of the mass. So that's that little mass section. And then I integrate r squared times this thing. So I stick that dm into there, and I'm integrating now over the radius, and the radius goes from length minus length over 2 to plus length over 2 of this rod. And yay, now it's a calc 2 problem. Integral of r squared dr with an m over l in the front. Integral of r squared over, r squared dr is r cubed over 3. Evaluated at each one of those endpoints. Each one of those endpoints, r cubed over 3 for l over 2 is l cubed over 24. And the other side is minus L cubed over 24, so they add and I get a 12. And that's where the magic 12 comes from. So that is the moment of inertia as calculated from that integral for a rod going around the center. We can do the same thing for the rod spinning around the end, where now this integral is not from minus L over 2 to L over 2, but from 0 to L. Okay, and from 0 to L, you can almost see right away what happens is the zero drops out and I get an L cubed over 3 and ML squared over 3, which is exactly what this is. So you can almost use the same exact analysis to get the rod going around the end. We're going to do the parallel axis theorem after the break, and I'll show you a niftier, slightly different way of doing that magic. So come back at 25 after and we'll go over stuff for 10 minutes. Yay, and I'm still recording. What's up, Chase? Yeah, it's going to be open. It's going to be just like the midterm.
Oh, really?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, wow.
I mean, why?
Well, you didn't but,
there were a lot. I mean, remember, it can be a curse as well as a blessing.
Yeah, I mean, like, these tests.
You can spend
really
a lot of time watching YouTube videos and doing all sorts of stuff.
That's what I like to do. It's like, the YouTube videos for each problem, because that's what it helps. But yeah, we wasn't on the syllabus on the website.
But yeah, so I'll add it to the syllabus, but it's going to be like that. So, Kevin,
I emailed you this morning.
It was one of those years? Okay, yeah. So
it was hard to tell. You found the one section of the test where I had sort of neat handwriting.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It might be me, but it looks too neat to be.
I'm pretty sure it's you, though. I tried to pick neat. Yeah, exactly. He's got them all. It should be on top. Hey! Did you get your exam back?
I did.
You did well this time.
Thank you. Good job. I appreciate it. I'm just curious. For this one over here, I started working out and I realized.
I
zero put it over there. And I swear I didn't just add that or something. You see, I didn't erase anything.
Yeah,
and
no,
I had put answers for all the other ones.
I'll add it.
I mean,
that's fine.
It's not really. I mean, I did fine.
Yeah.
I was just curious if, for future reference, if something's zero, if I need to prove why it's zero. That's why I thought why.
There is no. Everybody else. I mean, generally, as long as people had the right answer written down, then they got. So I'll add that.
All right. No,
I'll add that
problem.
In
yeah,
your final
I said,
score.
I would just wanted to know for future reference if I needed to prove something to be zero first.
No. Okay. I mean, generally, it helps to show your work, even when something's zero. But in that,
that's what I would do. Like, I was starting to work out the tension of the string, and I'm like, wait a minute, there's no work that way.
Right. Well, and so many people in the class had gotten so many people in the class just remember the homework. I assigned you guys enough homework where the normal course was zero. It was helpful to prep for the exam at least. So I will add that in for you. Which problem was that again? That was problem three. Your problem. Column four,
five,
exactly.
So I'll
add that in for you. No problem. Sure.
The number on top is divided into 110, correct?
That's correct, yeah. But I mean, it's out of 100 in terms of grading for the final. In terms of relative grading for the final, anything above 100 is like extra credit or something like that. Yeah.
Okay. That's
interesting. How's it going, Holmes?
Yeah.
He's got your exams. Everybody's exams are back there.
Alright, I don't think I
want to
know, but...
And I still owe you homework, though, so I was under the weather in the past couple of days. You're on my list.
Is it okay if I go up to like the
learning center?
Yeah, and start doing the homework. So I don't want to talk about
that. Yeah.
I
haven't assigned the homework yet, too. So I need to pick out problems. Yeah, that's something I usually do after. I'm also giving Anna a makeup exam after class, too. So I'll be up there, and we can. So how's about we go up there anyway, and I'll pick out. We'll pick out problems from some of the other books.
Okay, that's fine. Because that slope problem, I knew. I was like that one. I did a lot of studying for that one.
Yeah, and you knew it. Right?
Yeah, I was like, okay, then all the courses go this way, and like that was the one I kind of talked about other professors before. Yeah, I wish I had my study log from last week, because I show you like 5 hours of study logs for that one day. And we're all going over problems like that. So
did they actually let you?
They didn't give me the crap.
Yeah.
It's in regulations, so
it's all that
matters.
It's in regs, okay. As long as you clear regs, then I'm not going to get the merits.
I like to go over there and just go through some problems and stuff. Yeah. Just things that I can, like...
Yeah, let's focus on, I mean, all the rotational motion stuff is going back to point now, so there are kind of good examples now.
I think, like, my second time.
That helps reduce some of the anxiety as well.
Okay. All right, thank
no
you.
Problem. Thank you. Gearing up for the midterm, huh? I mean, sometimes you're not here. I post the audio, right? I mean, you know, but there's nothing quite like, you know, me waving my hands around and doing. You're so excited about what? Using what? You're on the right trajectory. You're fine. So, and what I'll do is when I send out the emails to everybody, I'll have kind of. So what I do is I take. So the way I take this into account in the projected grading is I take the higher of the two midterms, right? And then I weight that extra because there's going to be another midterm, and I presume that you're going to do as well on the final midterm as you did at the very least on the best of the first two. So you're on that right trajectory. And then the final is also weighted. Because I don't know.
How do you do your grading scale? Is it similar?
It's a little bit curved. It all depends on the class and how the class is.
That's how my statics teacher, he does it so like 60% of the class passes.
Yeah. And generally I'm between 60 and 70% of the class passing. Because in this course, there are quite a few people who have had this a couple of times before. And
yeah, so we're
like, yeah, I mean, like, you know, these guys over here, I mean, Dylan had two years of Calculus physics in high school or something like that.
Yeah, see, like, I've never done physics before.
Yeah,
so
exactly. So I don't want overperformers to wreck the curve because they're clearly pinning the curve. On the other hand, those people in here that are clearly not getting it at all probably should drop and rework on some of the basics and come back. So you're not at that level. You're on a level where you'll get through probably and be just fine, particularly since, you know, address your deficiencies and, you know, you improved on this exam, you'll improve on the next one, so you're on the right trajectory. The other thing is I also try and take as much of the homework as I can into account because it means that you generally are putting in some of the effort to do the work. On the other hand, I can see how long you spend on each problem. So if you check every problem and just type in the shit, I'm going to get angry. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So.
No, I usually get a 2 to
do the homework. Good. Okay. Yeah. Sounds great. Thanks. Do you prefer Matt or Matthew, or does it matter? Matt. Matt it is. Easy to remember. Okay. I always feel like So who here wants to become a teacher someday? Good. Because dang, it's tiring. I get like my cardio up here working out all the time and just dancing around and waving sticks and shit. So it's like, viva la France. No, anyway. So
So let's go back. There's another couple little things that we need to apply. And right now you have a ton of information that you can use to do problems, right? We've gone through rotational kinematics. We've gone through rotational Newton. Now, there are problems where things rotate and move linearly at the same time, and all of it's like, oh no, my brain is going to explode because this ball is rolling across the surface, and there's friction, and there's rotation, and there's linear translation, and it's like the incorporation of everything you have learned so far into one mechanics problem when you're sitting and playing pool with your buddy or something like that. I'm going to try and give you homework that accelerates you up through that curve. Some of the homework you'll look at and you'll go, man, this is so easy. I'm just falling asleep at the wheel here because it's just divide by R, divide by R. It's going to ramp up quick. Do not take it for granted, because before long you're going to look at this and go, a ring is rolling down a ramp at a certain velocity and blah, 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 and I have to incorporate conservation of momentum, conservation of energy, rotational motion, linear translation motion, all of that stuff into one narrative for a problem, and I don't know where to start. Okay? So be aware that even though some of the initial homework will be fairly easy, I will make sure to put in some noggin cracking homework near the end, particularly for the advanced students, that tries to challenge you. Because I know there are some students in this class who are sitting here going, oh yeah, physics is a breeze this semester. And other students are going, I'm working my ass off here to try and understand everything, and I'm enjoying the challenge, and I'm getting a benefit out of it. How many of you feel like that? Yeah, you suck ups. Right, so it's true though, okay? And just like any other technique, just like playing the piano, playing the guitar, I play both, I can still remember the moments when all of a sudden you think to yourself, oh my God, I'm actually playing and not really thinking about every note. And I'm playing. My technique and my practice in my technique has gotten me to the point where I am now able to think more about the music than about the notes. And if I can get you, some of you, to the point where you can think more about the physics than the math, or more about the problem than the setup, and you can start to see the path, that's my objective that I set out at the beginning, which is change your worldview and give you some insights through practice into how to look at the world like a physicist. Doesn't mean you'll be a physicist, but gosh, if you're a Mechie, you're damn close to a physicist already. If you're an EE, you're damn close to a physicist already, just in a different subdiscipline. Okay? So, where was I? Oh, yeah, moment of inertia, rotating stuff. Calculus, right? Applied calc 2. Now, it gets really, really boring to do an integral around the center versus an integral around the end. All I did was change the extremes, right? I mean, in this example, where I worked through and showed the calc, you know, one simple quadratic integral into a cube, and then I pointed at that and I said, oh, it's easy to change this up so that this integral is now the integral from one end of the stick down to zero, and I'm rotating around the end. All I did was change the limits of the integral. Turns out that there's a nice little theorem that generalizes that tremendously, and it's called the parallel axis theorem. If I'm rotating around here versus rotating around a parallel axis just slightly off of that, all I did was really move a little chunk of mass from this end all the way down to this end as I slid, right? All the other mass is the same. All I really did was just change something by a little bit, and all I really did in moving from this to this was I moved half of the stick from nearby to further away. And I moved half of the stick, essentially half of the an entire length of the stick. I moved the top down to here. I moved the center down to the bottom. So I moved half the stick, the entire length of the stick, to go from this to this. That's really just changing the extremes of my integral. And so to generalize that, there's a beautiful little theorem, and it's called the parallel axis theorem. And the parallel axis theorem says that if I rotate around any parallel axis that's set apart from some axis that I already calculated, from the center of mass of the object, now what I can do is I can recalculate a new moment of inertia by just translating out the entire mass of the object times that distance off the main axis that I moved. So it's a little bit, you know, it may not be completely clear. I'll make it clear in a second with an example or two. We'll maybe even apply it to our stick and see where we get with our stick. So what I do is first I take the moment of inertia around the center of mass. So let's take our stick here. And let's take our stick and rotate it around the center. So this is L over 2 and this is L over 2. And this is the center of mass. This is the moment of inertia around the center of mass. And I calculated it out, you know, r squared vm, blah, blah, blah. And I ended up getting ml squared over 12. I did that in the slide. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to move the axis by a distance L over 2. Okay, and now, instead of redoing the integral, I can use the parallel axis theorem. And yes, it's a theorem in the sense that you can actually prove it if you work through some of the math. It's relatively straightforward. And I can say that the new moment of inertia around this end is equal to the moment of inertia times the center of mass plus the mass times that length that I moved, that distance that I moved, squared. Okay? This was the distance that I moved for the parallel axis theorem. Remember, the parallel axis theorem said the new center, the new moment of inertia is the center of mass, moment of inertia, plus the mass times the displacement squared. Here the displacement is L over 2. So do I get that right? Let's see. So that's ML squared over 12. And this is ML squared over 4. Right? So that's ML squared over 12 plus 3 ML squared over 12. 4 ml squared over 12, which is ml squared over 3. What was the moment of inertia of a rod around the end? Ml squared over 3. You say, oh, you know, yawn. All I needed to do was change the limits, Todd. That one was easy. Well, but the great thing about this is it doesn't apply. It's a theorem that's enough that doesn't apply just to sticks. It applies to anything. Okay? And so the parallel axis theorem, which is the moment of inertia around an offset axis, is equal to this moment of inertia around the center of mass plus md squared
if I've got some crazy thing and I know the moment of inertia around the center axis, the moment of inertia around this axis, I can figure out. A side effect of this, this thing here is always greater than the center of mass, the moment of inertia around the center of mass. The result of this basically means that the moment of inertia to rotate anything is minimum through its center of mass. If you want to find the center of mass of something, one thing you could do is figure out how hard is it to rotate. Find the place where it's easiest to rotate, and that axis is going through the object center of mass. Let's take a moment, because I've talked about center of mass a lot, and let's take a quick moment, just real quick, before I let you go, to do another application of Calc 2 or Calc 3. This will actually, you'll do in Calc 3 quite a lot, and that is we talk about center of mass. Okay, center of mass is a position in space. Right? If I'm looking at the center of mass of something like this, it's, you know, a certain location underneath this board where I'm going to do my Frisbee spin move. How do I calculate the center of mass in general? Well, what I can do is I can add together all the masses together and weight them by their radii, or add together all the radii and weight them by their masses. It turns out that what you do is you sum together all the individual pieces of mass and their locations and divide that by the total mass of the object. Okay, this is the total mass. And this is kind of like mass weighted. By distance, or by location, by radius, right? If you do this, you see the units kind of work out. All, you know, this will give me kilograms, that'll give me kilograms, all the kilograms will cancel, I'll end up with a distance or a location. If I want to do this the true calc way, of course, this is the integral of mass located at some position, integrated over space, divided by the total mass of the object, right? And since this is an integral over space, that actually ends up being, you know, a triple integral over all three dimensions if you really have a physical object. So you'll get to this in Calc 3. This is not something for this course, but you should know at least the philosophy of how you calculate a center of mass is just averaging out the mass over all positions that it's located in. How do you average something? You add it all together and divide by the sum of the masses to get the units right. Nothing more than that. So we'll come back and we'll do problems. I'll assign some homework that'll be due next Wednesday, next Monday. We'll do problems.